She reduces, reuses, and recycles. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. You are indeed listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. Our show is made possible today due to the generous support of the Fairfax Companies, true leaders in the business of sustainability. Since 1989, Fairfax has strived to be a leader in sustainability and is totally dedicated to improving the environment through creative and innovative management practices. We thank them for their support, and we invite you to visit them at thefairfaxcompanies.com. So everybody take a deep breath, because you're going to need it for the next 60 minutes. The name of our show today is Protecting You from Toxins, and that is exactly what this organization and the man who founded it are going to tell us about. We are honored to have as our guest for this hour Michael Green. He's the executive director for the Center of Environmental Health. And a little bit about Michael: he is nationally, and I would say internationally, recognized as a leader in the fight for consumer safety products, safety in consumer products, healthier environments for children, our children, and for collaborating with businesses for a sustainable future for all of us. In 1996, just about 20 years ago, he founded the Center for Environmental Health to protect all Americans, but especially children. And we'll really weave that into a lot of the show, and those who are most vulnerable from toxic chemical exposures, which they are now getting way before they're born. Prior to founding the center, Michael worked for the U.S. Department of Energy and the U.S. EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency. I have to say this, even though he'll probably be embarrassed, he has been called the Dalai Lama's garbage man. We always like to have a little fun with the show. After he designed a waste management plan for the Tibetan refugee community in exile in India. So we have to hear about that a little bit. And he also cared for the sick at Mother Teresa's mission in Calcutta. Michael, I have to say it again, what an honor it is to have you, and thank you for all your good work and for joining us today.
Thank you. It's an honor for me.
Well, there's lots to share, and let's go. I mean, it's like my mother had this expression that I'm trying to bring back. She used to say, oi, oi, oi. This is an oi, oi, oi kind of show. It's like, okay, Mom, I hope you're listening, because we're doing some good work here. So tell us a little bit about the work you did prior to founding the center. Everybody wants to know about what you did with Mother Teresa. Who wouldn't? And about the work you did with the Tibetan refugee community. And then we'll get on to the work you're doing now.
Okay. Well, when I worked in Calcutta, what happened was I went there. I went to Calcutta to volunteer in the founding the original mission that Mother Teresa created. And, you know, now there's hundreds all around the world. And what I discovered was that I thought I was a hotshot activist who really knew how to get things done and was, you know, tough and mentally tough and creative and resourceful. And I discovered that I was nothing compared to the nuns who were working there, who had taken a vow to live in the same conditions as the poorest of the poor and care for the poorest of the poor for the rest of their lives. And what it did is it made me realize, one, I wasn't all that much, and two, that the ability for a person to change the world is profound in a zillion different ways. And that just changed my whole orientation, because I realized that I wasn't as tough as those nuns. I wasn't living in Calcutta without a ceiling fan my whole life. And it basically created a sort of like a North Star of what is the definition of real commitment to be change in the world.
I so get it. And the purposeful part of that story to me is, yes, you are incredible, and yes, you are doing great things. It's not what you want to talk about, but I want to honor that. Because of that experience, it helped you on your journey to help all of us. So high five to Michael Green for experiencing that and then turning it into something very powerful for all of us. So what happened with the Dalai Lama? I always like to envision myself as 2 degrees of separation from the Dalai Lama because he's all that.
Well, first of all, he's a very strong environmentalist. And I had finished a master's in natural resources, and I had to either write a thesis or I had to go do something practical in the world. So that was a no-brainer. So, and I had worked on human rights with the Tibetans in the past, so I went to the government in exile and said, the Tibetan government in exile, and I said, can I, and this was earlier than, there was no email yet, so I sent them a fax and said, I'd like to come and I'd like to work in Dharamsala, where the Dalai Lama lives and where there's tens of thousands of Tibetan refugees, and do anything related to the environment for you for a year. I've got my own funding. And they came back with 3 ideas, 2 of which were kind of scholarly, and 1 of which was help us figure out what to do about all of the trash here from the tourists outside India, from the Indian tourists, and from the Tibetans. So then me and my boss, who was the locally elected leader for the refugee community, spent a year literally designing a garbage plan and then doing education for the Tibetans, for the Indians, and for the Western tourist-targeted businesses, because there's a lot of people who want to go to be near the Dalai Lama from all over the world, in 3 languages, in English, in Hindi, and Tibetan. And I know still they are practicing many of the things that we created at that time.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you. So it's still in place. And then, it's reading about you and the work of the center, it's such an intricate tapestry of woven experiences that got you here. And I'm very curious to hear about the work you did with the U.S. Department of Energy and the Environmental Protection Agency. And what happened during those times that moved you to actually start the center in 1996? What was going on?
The last couple of years before I started CH, I was at the U.S. Department of Energy in Washington, D.C. And this building is 3 blocks long. It goes from 9th Street to 12th Street, one long building. And if you stand in front of the undersecretary's office and you look all the way down the hall to the secretary's office, it's 3 blocks long. And so it just gives you a sense of the massiveness of this agency. And it's not even the biggest agency in the federal government. And my job was to involve the public about the local, around all of the DOE sites all around the country about how to clean up the nuclear waste and the hazardous waste that DOE was responsible for. And I found it very, even though my job was to empower the people at the local level to be more involved in decision making, I found the job to be profoundly disempowering. And it's because first of all, a lot of people in government are just there for a paycheck, and I have the luxury. I'm so spoiled. For the last 19 and a half years, I've been working with people who the paycheck is the gravy, not the good, the paycheck is the gravy for us in many ways here. So one was the sort of the low morale in government, and then the second was just the inability to make a change, because if I wanted to make some kind of change, I'd have to get sign-off from my boss, and he'd have to get sign-off from the secretary, and the secretary would have to get sign-off sometimes from the White House. And now I'm in a position where an intern who's, a college student can have an idea at 10 a.m., and at 2 p.m. we already are working on it. And it's just, it's an opportunity to make real change and see the fruits of your labor in a way that's harder to in government.
Yeah, there's not 97 layers and how many people harmed or got cancer just in the time that process is filled. Not to be totally Debbie Downer, but it's what's happening. So one of the things that I want to invite...
I do want to say, though, I feel great gratitude to the people who worked in government, because for the same reason that basically I wasn't tough enough to do it.
Right.
That I'm grateful that there are so many people who are having such an impact doing it.
Yeah, and there are good things that come out of it. Like I said, we don't want to vilify any of that, but it was preparing you for your journey, which to me is really the takeaway. You learn things that you can now, bring about change. So one of the things I want to invite our listeners to do, because so many of them listen to us on a podcast, is to press pause and go to the CEH website. It's CEH.org, and sign up for the newsletter. And I'm going to say that throughout the conversation, because this is a way that we can find out what you're up to and more of what you're doing. But look at the website and let's ask you, why are you here? What is your big mission for the Center for Environmental Health?
our job is to protect people from toxic chemicals. And the people that we are focused on, it doesn't mean they're the only ones we care about, but it's the ones we're focused on as our core, our children and people's ability to have healthy children, so children and future children. And the task of protecting people, especially that target population, from toxins when there's 84,000 chemicals being used by U.S. corporations, and very few of those chemicals have actually been tested for their health impacts, or at least adequately tested, is monumental. And so we have to pick our battles. So, for example, right now, some of our biggest campaigns are around chemical flame retardants. So the chair you're sitting in probably, not in the room with you, but I'm pretty confident, has chemical flame retardants that don't actually retard flames in the real world, but what they do is they are a profound health risk for firefighters, because if there's ever a fire there, the smoke will contain all these toxic chemicals. And they're also coming out bit by bit into the air in your office or in the listener's studios or homes or wherever they are. And those chemicals cause obesity and cancer and birth defects and a whole host of health outcomes that are just crazy, especially because they're not even, they don't even do any, they have no, you know, actual value. And so we're trying to eliminate them. So, for example, we're trying to get $1 billion of annual purchasing of by large institutions, like large companies or government agencies, to say we won't buy furniture with these chemicals in them anymore. Because if we get $1 billion a year in purchasing saying we're not going to buy it, the manufacturers are going to find a way to eliminate them.
Exactly. It's the power of the person, the consumer, which I'd like to talk about a little bit more. Let's go back a little bit.
I was just going to say, so that's just an example of the kind of campaign we have right now. But our job is to protect people from chemicals that people shouldn't have to have a PhD to go shop for a, you know, changing mattress for, you know, their newborn.
And, you know, one of the things that shocked me in doing the research for the show is that this is not any old stuff or things that have been taken care of. You had a blog about an ornament from the 49ers. I mean, the San Francisco 49ers. And I think I read that it contained 40 times the safe amounts of lead. I mean, we're talking about a Christmas ornament for the Christmas tree. And the blog title was something like, 49ers wish you a lead-filled Christmas. So whoever wrote it, that was a zinger to me.
Well, so that's Matt, and because Matt's not a 49ers fan, that's why he wrote it that way. But the thing is that that's a manifestation of globalization. That's because
it
the companies.
Is.
When I was a kid and I played with Mattel cars, Mattel made those cars. And today, when my son plays with a Mattel car, he's 9. The person who made that Mattel car is in Bangladesh or China or someplace else, and they have no relationship with the Mattel company, really. And so that means that who knows what, if they can't get the right paint, the right lead-free paint, they'll just get whatever they can get locally and ship it off to Mattel anyways, because they're too distant to be sort of accountable. And so the world is totally different than it was, you know, even just 20 years ago. And that's why you find things like Christmas ornaments full of lead.
But you had some early success when you started about lead in hair dye, which blows my mind. It's one of those, like, I'm so disgusted by this. And arsenic in wood playground structures. And I've had people on the show, a woman that has gotten arrested numerous times for her involvement with fracking. But what started her was the arsenic in playground structures. So what were those two products? Why were they your target? And what were you able to accomplish back then?
Gotcha. The arsenic in the play structures was because the arsenic kept the wood from rotting.
Right.
So the play structures lasted longer. Now, they could have made those play structures in many other ways without exposing kids to arsenic. We did testing, and we found that the arsenic comes right off on your hand, and then obviously children put their hands in their mouths. And So we, some combination of suing some of the manufacturers and then also some policy work, we and our friends basically eliminated the use of arsenic in play structures in a pretty quick time. Part of the problem is that these structures last a really long time, so even though that was 10 years ago, there's probably still some out there that kids are playing on today that have arsenic. If you think your child's playing on an arsenic-treated play structure, the best thing to do, unfortunately, would be the only thing you can do is to wash their hands before they eat, or and hopefully they're not putting their hands in their mouths. So that was that one, and we were able to change it very quickly because of arsenic and children. For the lead issue, we said that we were going to test every product made for children that could conceivably have lead in it. So that's not the hair dye, but it's all of these other ones.
Right.
And whichever ones had lead, we were going to force the companies to stop. And so that was CH was a much smaller organization at that time. It was a ridiculous idea. But what we did is we started testing children's products or products that were used by or on children. And the first thing that we found once we started that that had lead was baby powder. So then we found that the Johnson & Johnson and Pfizer and Squibb and all of these large multi-billion-dollar companies had lead in their baby powder. So we had a staff member pose as a buyer, and we went to the companies that sell the raw materials and said, we'd like to buy some zinc because it was the zinc that the lead was coming from. And zinc is in baby powder because it helps create less friction. It actually helps to have less diaper rash.
Right.
And we said we'd like to buy, you know, I don't remember what, but let's say we want to buy a ton of zinc. And can you tell us how much it would cost and what are the different options? And they told us, well, if you want the really clean stuff with less lead, it'll cost you this much. If you want the stuff that's got a little more lead, we can give it to you cheaper. Which means that these multi-billion dollar companies were making a conscious choice to expose newborns to lead where their skin was broken. It was crazy. So we did a bunch of media. We sued Pfizer. We sued Squibb. We sued Johnson & Johnson. They all eliminated the lead. And then we replicated that same strategy with, sometimes it was a collaborative strategy with the company. Sometimes it was, you know, litigation. It depended on the company and what we thought they would listen to. We replicated that to get lead out of baby bibs and candy imported from Mexico and lunch boxes and children's jewelry and toys. And by the time 2008 rolled around and we had already eliminated lead from all these children's products, we and a couple of friends went to the federal government to try to get legislation passed to ban lead in children's products. And it was a surprisingly easy cakewalk. And the reason it was because there were no companies who any longer had a vested interest in stopping, in defending their right to expose children to lead, because they had already all eliminated it.
So, like, how do you, for baby bibs, what purpose does lead serve in being in a baby bib? Is it help with the color? Because I know with hair dyes, it helps with the color.
With the hair dyes, it helped with the color. In plastic baby bibs and in a lot of these plastic things, the lead was in there for one of two reasons. One was to help with the color, and the other was if it was a cheap plastic like vinyl or PVC, that the lead helped to hold all of the different constituents together. The different pieces of the plastic, the different components of the plastic, were bound together by the lead, and so they were intentionally adding the lead, but now they're not. Now they've eliminated lead from all those kinds of products.
But it is in, I mean, it's like, okay, it's on Christmas ornaments, so that's a whole other conversation. But it was very timely to me because that just happened and we think we're safe and protecting our children and like, here, hang this ornament on the tree. And maybe if you're a baby, lick it and, you know, all that. It's like I said, I don't want to say it too many times, but it's disgusting. So,
the harder part is not actually the lead or arsenic, because those are chemicals that people know are toxic.
Right.
Most people know that about lead and arsenic. But when you go to the store and you see a sippy cup or a baby bottle that's got a big sticker on it saying that it's BPA-free, what you don't know is you're like, oh, that's great. That's the one I want because it doesn't have BPA. I don't know what BPA is, but I know it's bad, so I want that one that doesn't have it in it. What you don't know is what they replace the BPA.
Exactly. Exactly.
And so what's happening is that the companies are doing sort of like the BPA ended up on some bad list, either a bad PR list or a bad policy list. But for some reason, the company said, we can't have BPA in our products anymore. So then they go to their supplier, maybe in China, and say, next time you send us 150,000 baby bottles with our names embossed on it. We don't want any BPA in it. And then the Chinese provider will say, okay, gotcha. So then they will replace the chemical that makes it clear and hard with from BPA to some other chemical. That chemical is not as well tested, not as well known. It may have the exact same chemical properties and just a one molecule difference, and so it's called something else. And so what's much more challenging is what we call the toxic shell game, where companies switch away from things that are known and toxic to things that
Michael, hold that thought. We have to go to break, and this is what happens on radio. We'll be right back. Hate to break that stream of consciousness.
Join us for a new Mrs. Green's World episode every Saturday at 12 noon Pacific Time at MrsGreensWorld.com. All of our past shows are available as on-demand podcasts at MrsGreensWorld.com. Listen on your computer or mobile device using the iHeartRadio app. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and Instagram. We are a proud member of the Dream Vision 7, Glimmerglass, Green Radio Divas, Blog Talk, and Speak Up Radio Networks. If you have questions or comments about the show, write to us at info@MrsGreensWorld.com. We'd love to hear from you. And now, more with Mrs. Green.
Welcome back, everybody, and thanks for being with us. Sorry for that very short interruption. And Michael, I knew it. It's like I just want to hear every word, and then we cut you off. But anyway, just another quick shout out to the Fairfax companies for helping to make the show possible today. The name of our show is Protecting You from Toxins. We are so pleased to have as our guest for this hour Michael Green. He's the executive director for the Center for Environmental Health. He is a nationally recognized leader in the fight for consumer products, healthier environments for children, and collaborating with businesses for a sustainable future. And just a little bit more history. In 1996, he founded the Center for Environmental Health to protect all Americans, all of us, but especially children and those who are most vulnerable, which would be babies and children, and in some cases the elderly, from toxic chemical exposures. And a little bit more about Michael. In 2007, this is so noteworthy, he was awarded the California Wellness Foundation's Leadership Award and the prestigious Compassion in Action Award from the Dalai Lama Foundation. Michael, thanks for being with us. Sorry for the interruption. And tell us about the substitution. And it's not the first time I've heard about it or it's been discussed. But so BPA is bad. There's the big red warning sign that goes across that. And then the truth is, they could be putting in another harsh chemical that, as you said, hasn't been as widely publicized as cancer-causing or whatever else health risks it might bring.
Well, first of all, thanks for having me. And second of all, sorry I was rambling on too long and you had to go to commercial.
No, it wasn't you. It's like I'm listening and all of a sudden I'm getting these gestures. It's like, we got to go to break. And I'm like, no, stop. So go ahead.
So if you think about, you're a company, you don't make your own stuff. You don't make your own sippy cup.
Right.
And you now you're getting the public discourse is around BPA and that BPA is bad for the babies and therefore your customers and you're going to lose market share and possibly hurt your brand. So you got to fix that. So you call your supplier, wherever that person may be, and they may not be in the United States. They're probably not. And you say, I want the product just the way it is right now, but I don't want that BPA stuff in it. And your supplier, of course, is going to say, we'll figure out how to do that. And then they invariably will go to some other chemical, and the reason they do is because the process we use in deciding what chemicals we're allowed to be exposed to in the United States is that if it's not proven to be highly toxic, you can expose people to it. So people don't want to know. If you're in industry, you're better off not knowing the toxicity of the chemicals in your products, because if you don't know, then you don't have a problem. You don't have liability. You're not culpable. So what they'll do is they'll say no BPA, but they won't necessarily say yes to something else.
Right.
So there's companies who we have worked with. We've tried to help them to figure out what chemicals to actually proactively ask for, and it's kind of a radical thing. They don't have any experience or any practice with it. These are big multi-billion dollar companies who don't even know where to begin, because the chemical cousin switch game that I just described, where they switch from BPA to BPS, is something that is so hardwired in the way we do manufacturing that that the customers, meaning the people listening to this show, don't have a way to know what's safe and what's not safe. And the manufacturers, even if they totally want to do the right thing, don't have the capacity to do it.
And I love that, because I think about, you know, did you say chemical cousin switch game?
Yes.
We call it
the toxic shell game.
That is a hashtag waiting to go viral. Oh, my gosh. I love it. Really love it in a very sick, sad kind of way. But you're so right. And it also spends, it takes being a consumer, the constant consciousness requirement to go. I mean, I went to Whole Foods the other day, which I've been reading so many things about, started a word storm on my Facebook page about, you know, one of my issues is crated animals, and it's sickening. So I read a lot about Whole Foods, and, you know, unless I go visit the pig farm and watch what happens and see how it's transported and raised and slaughtered, how do I know what their rating system is? It's the consciousness that can drive consumers crazy, because it drives me crazy, and I like to think I'm really living consciously. So let's go on to, unless there's more you want to add to that, because it's shocking.
I do have one last thing.
Good.
It's the solution. So I describe that problem, and that problem is the greatest around things made out of petrochemicals. So anything made out of plastic is made out of oil or natural gas.
Right.
And so the solution is actually relatively simple, and that is to use natural materials. So when my kids were still using baby bottles and sippy cups, we used glass bottles instead of plastic, and they never broke, and they were great, and they're actually better because you could put them in the microwave,
right,
you could put them in the boiling water, and now at home still, my kids are older now, 7 and 9, still they eat. All the plates are either ceramic, means they're made out of clay, or they're wood. The only problem with wood is you can't put it in the dishwasher, or they're glass. And the fact that they're natural materials means that there were no chemists involved. There were no chemists involved that had to do some switch from the BPAs of the world to the BPSs of the world.
Got it. So there are alternatives that are so much better, and it's glass. We're still in the process of switching out all the glass that we have in our house. How many years later? So let's go into the food area. It's so vast, but you're working on in many areas related to safer, sustainable, not just food, but food production, and in support of more sustainable food production that really regenerates our natural resources, support healthier foods for consumer. Talk about whatever you want when it comes to the work you're doing with food, which is something we all have in common. We eat.
Well, one thing is the thing I just talked about. So
yes.
Food contact plastics, and that's that could be temporary stuff that you buy and then, you know, are in disposable containers, but also in the, lasting plastics. So for one example is there's a company that makes plastic foodware that millions of people have in their products in their homes, because it's a very big company with a lot of sales. And so there's if you think, baby plates are often plastic because people are afraid of something else breaking.
Right.
And so they wanted to know, how can we not only not have BPA in there, but how can we not have any of the chemical cousins that we've heard about from you? And so we worked with them to test their plastics but not for a chemical, because we didn't know what chemical to test for,
right,
for the reasons I said before, but for a health outcome. So we were testing to see, does it mimic a human hormone? Does it mimic estrogen? And so we sent it to a lab that we have worked with in the past, and we asked the lab to answer that question. And the way the lab answers that question, we worked with three different labs using different techniques. One of the labs, the way they did it, was they took human breast cancer cells and put it in a petri dish with a little bit of the plastic plate, and then another petri dish that just had the plate, that didn't have the plate. And if the breast cancer cells grew, if the plastic that was in the petri dish, if the breast cancer cells,
right,
that were in the petri dish with the plastic grew faster, that meant, than the other one, that meant something was telling those breast cancer cells to grow. And that something was a hormone. And so, and another technique was, another lab uses, is that they take a, they spliced a firefly gene and human vaginal cells, and if they put it in contact with this plate, if the firefly gene lit up, that meant that that communicated that it thought it was getting a chemical message.
Right.
And so then what you have is you have this, you know, this crazy 21st century science that's telling us whether or not these plates are safe. So that's one thing we're doing, is we're helping companies to figure out how they can make their products that food is stored in, that people are eating off of, without these toxins in them. Also, we work with our, there's an organization, there's a terrific organization called the Center for Food Safety that's based in Washington.
Love them.
And so we work really closely with them on a lot of different initiatives to try to get the worst and most toxic pesticides banned. And because the thing is that you could say, sure, buy organic, but at least today, organic is much more expensive, and it shouldn't be that only the affluent folks can have the ability to not be exposed to the most toxic pesticides in their food and in the food they're feeding their children. So we're also working to try to change the which kinds of pesticides are allowed to be used in society. And so to me, that work is very gratifying, because everybody, this is relevant for everyone in the world, the way we produce the food that we eat. Also, we do a lot of testing of food for toxic materials in the food, because you know, frequently you'll find candy or other stuff that has lead or cadmium or other toxic materials in there. So we do a lot of testing, and when we find it, then we go to those companies and say they've got to take them out.
And it's what I love about the work that you do, the whole integration of thought that's so important for all of us, is it's not just what the food is in its raw form, for lack of a better description. So yes, it's organic, but then you have to really be conscious about not just what you're serving it in or storing it in, but what it was packaged in, because it's food all along the journey, which doesn't even come close to addressing all of the social justice issues with the manufacturing of food and the harmful chemicals that our workers are exposed to. But is that a good, you know, connecting the dots, look carefully, and
yes,
what are we packaging them in? And, you know, the list goes on.
And, yes, and also when we create, whether we as activists or whether people who are listening to the show as consumers, create demand for food that is not grown with the worst pesticides, for example, then that also has a strong social justice benefit, because the farm workers are then not exposed to the most toxic materials because there's not enough demand for them, and the food manufacturers switch to some other way of growing the food.
And there's almost, it's like they're the hidden, I mean, talk about the hidden victims of our very vast food production system. And I don't know, I'm very hopeful about how much it seems to be being talked about, the migrant workers and the toxicity, not in some of the political arenas, but there are lots of us in the environmental awareness world that are bringing this to the consumer, because I think that our consumers care more and more and more. What about the touching on the GMOs? Why shouldn't we all have a right to know what's in our food? We are what we eat. So what's your stand on, you know, the makers of GMOs and our right to know what's in our food?
Well, there's so many things.
There's so many. I know. I'm like, why did I ask that question? It's another show.
No, it's all good. But so first of all, yes, it goes without saying that people should have a right to know. And the fact that the large food companies right now are trying to get federal legislation passed saying that states cannot require food manufacturers to say whether there's GMOs in their food is so counter to everything that I think of as what, you know, what I was brought up as what's American.
Yes, our right to know.
So that part's a no-brainer. I mean, the thing about GMOs is that there's two concerns about, categories of concerns about GMOs in my mind. One is, do you want to eat them? Are you worried about their safety? And the other is, if they are, so that's one. Then there's the second one, and that is the impact of the use of genetically modified crops on the environment as a whole.
Bingo.
So what I'm referring to specifically is that if you look at Roundup, which is the most heavily used pesticide in the country, the way that pesticide is designed to be used is it's an herbicide that's supposed to kill the other plants and only leave the plant that's the food crop, the corn or whatever. But that means that they need Roundup Ready, and that's the jargon. They need Roundup Ready corn. So Monsanto, the manufacturer of the pesticide, also is the manufacturer of the corn because it's a GMO corn. So they're genetically modifying the corn so that it can survive the spraying of this toxic chemical, so that they can spray more of the toxic chemical on the fields and kill everything except the corn, because the corn has been modified by Monsanto to survive its toxic herbicide. And so if you think about the impacts on the farm workers, on the people who drink the water that runs off from the farms, and also from the consumers who are eating the pesticides, even if you're not worried about eating genetically modified crops, those are all spectacular reasons for people to have the right to know, and for us to not set up a system where we're encouraging more pesticide use.
And I've written newsletters where I say, honestly, folks, do we want to eat something that's called Roundup Ready? I mean, it's like, come on, I don't feel good about that. And to me, this is, you don't need to be a scientist to figure out that it is sprayed, which means parts of it, particulates are airborne. It goes into our water supply. I could be getting it sprayed from God knows where in my water supply when it rains and carries things great distances. And there are dead zones. There are pictures all over of people just taking pictures for dead zones in our rivers where basically nothing lives because of what the water streams produced once they were served. So, I mean, you can almost not stop me on this topic. It's consumers, wake up and let's stop it. And Monsanto. Yeah. Okay. It's I sound like I get on a soapbox around this issue, but I don't want to eat anything called Roundup Ready, and I do have a right to know what's in my food, and then I can make a decision, yes, I want to eat that, or no, I don't. This is one of those, just my signature piece of asking a question that will require some answering now and when we go to break in 3 minutes, but I'd like you to talk a little bit about, you know, consumer power, or what I call the power of the purse versus policy work. Because from where I sit in this 10-year journey, consumers have lots more power than we believe we do. And there are examples of things that have changed, like organic milk when mothers demanded it. So there is that piece, boycotts work of products. Like you said, hit them where it hurts, the bottom line. What's the return on investment? But then what about your feedback to us as consumers to take a little bit deeper cut and help support policy changes? Is it your belief that we have to step our game up a little bit as consumers and not just look at what we buy, but the policy work that you're doing and how to support it?
Well, I'm aware that we're about to go to a break, but my first soundbite is we can't shop our way out of these problems. The power of the purse is one component of an integrated strategy that we have to use all kinds of different methods. And so there's an opportunity for people to have a policy role that they may feel like that's beyond my capacity. Sure, I can shop consciously, but I can't do that. But groups like the Center for Environmental Health can actually make it possible for people to have a policy impact. And I have a few thoughts on how they can do it. So you're encouraging people to sign up for our newsletter, then they'll get information on how they can have an impact. Because, we on a regular basis, I think once a month, we give people an opportunity to take some very specific action. Call your congressperson and here's how here's the number to do this, or write this CEO and ask them to do that. And often it's thanking people, because if a powerful person does something we want them to do, we want those people to hear from us too, so that they know that people are watching and listening, and that their peers who they talk to know that they're going to get noticed if they do the right thing.
So I had this wonderful guest on. All my guests are wonderful, I have to say that, but Sephora Berman, who wrote a book called This Crazy Time. And that's what she said. She said exactly that. We can't just change the world by changing our light bulbs. We have to change public policy, and we are listened to. That's the thing that I want to emphasize. If we get a petition going, and within a couple of days there are 500,000 signatures, somebody's watching, and they're testing the will of the people. We'll be right back. So much more from this amazing human being and his company, his movement, Michael Green. Everybody, stay here with me.
Mrs. Green's world's mission is to preserve the planet by creating a global community of people who care about the health of the Earth. We educate, inform, and inspire. Mrs. Green's World is an independent, non-political, agenda-free voice. Your generous gift enables all of us to explore the issues facing the health of the planet in a comprehensive way. As a Mrs. Green's World sustainer, you can assist us in offering trusted information, providing listeners with the tools to make their own conclusions and choose their own steps to create a healthier planet. Visit MrsGreensWorld.com and click on Become a Member today.
Welcome back, everybody, and thanks for joining us. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to, and we're certainly being given the great opportunity of lots of things to think about, and also things on which about which we can have an impact. I love the quote, "We can't shop our way out of these problems." That might be my favorite quote for the show so far, Michael, and it's really an important one. We can so easily, sometimes when I sign a petition, I time myself, and it takes 30 to 60 seconds. And your vote can then count when you're getting something before the EPA or a bill that might pass. And I even call my congressman. That's like a pain for me. But it's like, oh, yeah, you might be saving a child today by your one phone call. So is there anything else that you want to talk about in terms of policy work and the importance of it for making the big shifts we have to see happen?
Sure. There's a couple of things. One is that that if you call, I just want to riff off of what you just said. If you call an elected official, they assume that you're speaking for 100 people who sent an email. And if you send an individual email, they're assuming you count for about 100 people who signed up to a petition. And so what that means is signing on the petition is great because you are joining with thousands of other people and it's having an impact. But if you actually pick up the phone and make a call, assuming that is such a burdensome thing to do in everybody's busy lives that unless you're the person who calls them every week on the front top, that you're speaking for a lot of people. So don't underestimate the power of being able to call elected officials and speak, even though you're speaking to an intern, because the intern writes down the notes,
yes,
and then that gets to their boss, and then the boss sees, oh, there's, you know, 27 people called about that topic. Oh, there must be, you know, tens of thousands of people thinking,
yes,
about this, right? So that's just one thought I have. Second one is the consumer power is valuable, especially when it's organized. So if you're looking to buy furniture or children's products without these chemical flame retardants that I talked about earlier, you can go to our website and you can see which ones do and which ones don't have these chemical flame retardants in them. And that gives you the power to influence not only what's in your home and the health of your family, but the global home too, because you're going to be one of the sort of voters in by voting in with what you bought to influence the way things are made in the future. Also, another thing people can do is on our website, if you work at a company or a university or a government agency, that you can ask them to sign our pledge so that, because if we can get to $1 billion in annual purchasing of companies that say, we won't buy furniture with these toxic chemicals in them anymore and bring those toxic chemicals into our office. So Yahoo has signed it, and Kaiser Permanente, and Genentech, and Harvard, and Staples. So we've got close to $700 million in annual purchasing promised already. So, and when we get to $1 billion, then we're going to be able to have a really powerful story to tell to all the manufacturers to eliminate toxic chemicals from our home. And if people have HBO Go, they can watch this really great documentary about the chemical flame retardants, and it's not one of those boring talking head documentaries.
Right.
It feels like you're watching a whodunit. It's so incredible. And so it's called Toxic Hot Seat is the name of the film. And so those are some things that can empower people to actually have an impact. And purchasing, definitely the power of the purse that you described is very important. It's just that it's not exclusively the only thing that's going to win the day.
No, I love your quote. It's great. I mean, I'm going to use this when I talk to other people. I'll make believe that I made it up. We can't chop our way out of these problems. Everybody will get that. It's really not just about the conscious consumer. And I love what you said about when we call our congressman, because I did say it's a pain in the neck. And I'm like, really, Gina, do you have 2 minutes? And a lot of times you don't even have to talk to a person, which I find great, especially given some of our elected officials in Arizona, but you get to leave your message and you have to give your zip code and you have to provide more information and your phone number. But I'm certainly willing to do that. And it really is, there's a lot of power there. I don't know if we have time to go into this, but it's probably one of the most emotional topics for me to talk about, because I get so absolutely angry and sad, and it's about fracking. I had Winona Howder on my show about 2 years ago from Food and Water Watch, and you know, she just tears the lid off it all and is so passionate about this. So it is an issue that you decided to take on. So talk about why and all of the harmful health effects from this process of extracting things from the ground. I actually have a quote that I wanted to read from your website, but talk to us about the passion around fracking and why we should care.
Okay. Our offices are in New York and California, and I'm in the California office. And in California, there is a drought, and the governor, Governor Jerry Brown, is asking us to not water our lawns. Meanwhile, the oil companies are allowed to dump wastewater from fracking, which means it's the chemicals that the toxic chemicals from that they use to extract the oil out of the ground, and they are allowed to dump that water into what is connected to our sources of drinking water. So what it tells you is two things. One, it tells you is the power of the oil and gas companies, that while we're being asked to not water our lawns, they're allowed to contaminate our sources of drinking water. And then the second thing is that the importance of doing something about this has not risen to the level of that we can't even get that done in California. So the problem with fracking, and it's not just fracking, there are other methods that are very similar to fracking that are not called fracking. And I say that so that people don't get tricked later when they learn, because I think the oil companies are going to very quickly try to not use the word fracking and claim, well, we're not fracking because we're doing something else. But that something else is almost the same thing. It's like the chemical cousin that we talked about earlier for BPA versus BPS. So it's like just like fracking, but not exactly. They might be called steam injection or chemical this or that kind of thing. And so it contaminates our drinking water. In some places, it's causing earthquakes when they're in basically every place but California. But it also is accelerating the process that we can extract out of the ground the fossils that we burn that are cooking the planet. And what we need to actually have an honest conversation about in our society is, when will we say we're going to leave the rest in the ground? So that I had not seen anybody talking about that in the really mainstream media like the New York Times until the day after the Paris Accord.
Right.
And that
COP
was the 21, first time,
yeah.
And that was the first time that I saw in the New York Times a reference to leaving, when are we going to leave the rest in the ground, that wasn't sort of put down, kind of a put down of some kind of wacky, crazy person suggested that idea. And 20 years from now, everyone's going to be having that question. When are we going to leave the rest in the ground? Today, it's an unusual topic. Someone might have just heard that for the first time and say, what, we're going to leave it in the ground even though we can get it? Oh, I didn't think of that. And so what fracking is doing is it is it is slowing us down and creating a lack of incentive for us to have an honest conversation about when are we going to leave the rest in the ground, because we can't leave the rest in the ground until we start to invest in the alternatives. And we're not going to invest in the alternatives if the oil companies are allowed to trash our local environments and make people sick so that they can, you know, have their last gasp of their last $1 billion in profits before they're going to have to make a transition.
And maybe one of the things that aggravates me the most is that, you know, our cost for dirty coal, fossil fuel, is about 3 cents per, what is it, megawatt per kilowatt, right?
Okay.
Well, then solar has a much higher cost per kilowatt hour. Well, the conversation is that's not a true figure at all, because into that factoring of the cost is nothing for the breaks and the subsidies to the oil and gas industries. You know, and the paragraph that I wanted to read from your website, I copied it and I bolded it, and it says the oil and gas industry is the only industry in the United States that is allowed to inject hazardous materials unchecked directly into or adjacent to underground drinking water supplies, despite the risks fracking has been largely exempted from federal laws. And, you know, I wanted to add, inject them into the earth. That would be Mother Earth that nurtures us and gives us life. So I want to get the drama element involved. We're not just injecting it into dirt. It's the earth, that which gives us life. So another one of get off the soapbox, but learn about fracking and don't believe the natural gas commercials about the safer alternative, and it's all United States fuel. Just that's, you know, don't believe those lies. So what else do you want to say about fracking?
You said that your mom, I don't remember what you said, your mom said something about Oy Vey. So my mom would call that mashugana, what you just said.
Yes.
That's just crazy. I want to quote Lisa Jackson, who was the EPA administrator for the first 6 years of the Obama administration, because she says regularly that you think making changes to address climate change is expensive. Well, let me tell you what's really expensive, and that's climate change. And
yes.
The economic argument is such an incredibly short-sighted perspective. If you look at the Superstorm Sandy in New York, it cost billions and billions of dollars to get everything back up and running because of the salt water that had damaged so much in New York. And that's going to, by definition, is going to be happening more and more, and the expense is going to be astronomical. And every penny we spend now is going to save us dollars later.
Dollars and lives. I mean, the lives of our children. That's what I always hope. Like, if you think there's a block in your brain about this, we're not talking about politics and the polarization of if you're an environmentalist, you're one party or whatever. We're talking about our lives. So don't let that cloud the discussion. It shouldn't be a discussion in the political arena along party lines. The party line should be, do we care about our children and our grandchildren and whoever's going to come after them? It's about us, and that's why we named the show. You know, we really said, what can we name the show? I mean, we intentionally think about those things and protecting you from toxins. That's what your work is to me in a
right.
line. Protecting your work. Okay, what about, if we have time, it's just time so flies when you're learning.
Can I just say one thing
that people
who are listening to this show have that is of great power is the ability to talk to other people they know. And so you and I, you know, after this 45, 50 minutes, we're pretty much on the same page on just about everything, even the expressions our moms use. And the difference is that there's an opportunity to talk to people who might not see it the way we do, because, you know, there are actually millions of people in America who are unsure whether climate change is real and are certainly unsure whether we should spend any money on it, because it's going to be, you know, maybe something that happens in the future. So if you're concerned about it, one thing you can do is you can talk to those people, and you're not going to convince them if you judge them. You got to talk to them. You got to meet them where they're at, and you got to speak to them in a way that communicates compassion for their perspective and not judgment, and and openness and an inquiry into how they're thinking about it as compared to, you know, laying down the gauntlet. And that is possibly the most powerful thing that people can do. I realize Thanksgiving now just passed, so that Thanksgiving dinner, you know, where you talk to your crazy right-wing uncle, you know, is now 11 months away, but talking to people like that in a way that they can hear you, even if they don't, doesn't seem like you had any impact, because then they're walking away possibly thinking about it, especially if you come at them with compassion as compared to judgment.
And compassion, and I, the other part that I would like to inject in that is asking questions. And I love the tagline for our show, we don't tell you what to think, we just want you to.
I love it too.
Sometimes I ask people, what do you care about? Tell me what you care about. And of course, a lot of times family comes up. And weaving it into the conversation, so important what you said, in a non-judgmental and non-threatening way. As soon as somebody starts attacking my beliefs, the bunker goes up. It's like, how dare you? And I just, the brain literally shuts down, and I can't, and, you know, it's like putting your fingers in your ear and going, nah, 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 nah. Which brings me back to my mother. I wasn't allowed to do that. But it's really a question of finding a common ground. And I can't, support Berman was such a powerful impact in my journey. I heard her speak at a social venture network conference, and then I read her book, and then she was on the show. But she talks about that in her book as well. And she talks about, you know, blockades, boycotts, and boardrooms. And this is where she talks about find the common ground with leaders of these companies and policymakers where everybody can get on the, you know, the concentric part of the Venn diagram where we're all in this together, folks. So yeah, don't attack. It doesn't ever work. Okay, we have about 4 minutes left if my clock serves me correctly. Michael, I know this is going to be hard, but give us a couple of takeaways for what we can do. My absolute right out of the chute is one thing that everybody listening to this broadcast can do is go to ceh.org and sign up for your newsletter. You want to be an informed consumer, do that. What else would you say to bring this down to manageable bites? What
Sure.
else can people do?
Here's another thing you can do. You can also, this is also on our website, you can download the pledge, the CEH Furniture Purchasing Pledge, and go and take it to your boss and say, hey, do you think that our company or our wherever you work could actually sign this like Harvard did and like Staples did and like Genentech did and like Yahoo did and like Kaiser did, and say that we're not going to buy these, we're not going to buy furniture with these toxic chemicals anymore, because then it will eliminate those chemicals from your workplace. So that's a very specific thing people can do. People can buy organic if they can afford it, and if not, they can at least look for by looking at the nature of what they are buying,
right,
to buy more natural things. So like the example of the plastic sippy cup with who knows what they replaced the BPA with versus the glass one, or anything made out of natural materials is just another thing that you can do to protect your own family in your own home. Another thing that you can do is if you did sign up for our newsletter, you're going to then about once a month get an opportunity to thank some CEO or some elected official, or make a demand of some CEO or elected official, and to actually take the time to do it is another thing that you can do. And then let's pick one more. Is the compassionate conversations, the courageous but compassionate conversations that you have to have with the people who don't see things the way you do, to invest the energy to do those things, to have those conversations in a way that actually works, which is hard.
Yeah, but it's so powerful. I mean, those are great. Those are really great. I'm going to re-listen to this show and get some really good sound bites for us to get out on our social media as to why everybody should listen to this show and re-listen to it. And I want to say something again about your website. It really matters to me when I go to a website as a consumer, as someone hopefully living quite consciously, to be able to navigate. And kudos to your team that created a friendly website that invites you in and wants you to keep on clicking. As I say, it's like click, click, click. I got to read about that. So it takes hours for me to find out all of the good work you're doing. And I thank you for that. And I can't say that enough, and I appreciate the work you're doing, and can't wait to see the progress that you make for on all of our behalf. Everybody, great show. Next week, Will Allen, farmer, founder, and CEO of Growing Power, planting the seed for urban farming. I hope you'll join us. Make it a great green day. And Michael Green, thanks for showing up in Mrs. Green's world.
Thank you, Gina.